Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Aaron Byrne, the author of Wings, Gifts of Art, Life, and Travel in France, and several other books that she's written. Great travel writer, going to give us a little bit of a walk through her experiences in Paris and other parts of France. Thank you very much, Aaron, for coming.
Thank you, George. Such an honor to be here. Welcome. Thank you for coming. You are a well-traveled group. And so this evening we will be escaping to France for a while, but then we'll be returning. We return together and maybe conjure up a little bit of hope. My publisher and editor, Larry Habiger, is here. He's right back there. Traveler's Tales published this book, and he also edits and publishes the best travel writing anthologies, that also the best women's travel writing, 100 places in Italy and France, every woman should go. And Traveler's Tales just published a fiction book called Billy Grogan, about Ireland and New York. I also have two other fellow writers here who are in my book. Kimberly Lovato is also back here, and she is quoted in my tastes chapter talking about food. And Jeff Greenwald is also back here, and Jeff is quoted in my transformations chapter talking about a million different universes. So this evening we'll go into the mind of an artist, onto a street in occupied Paris, walk a few in Vincent's footsteps in Arles, and venture out into current Paris. Wings is about how I was changed by traveling through France with the ghosts of artists and other historical figures who shared with me their guides to living. The book opens with this quote by Joseph Campbell. If what you are following, however, is your own true adventure, if it is something appropriate to your deep spiritual need or readiness, then magical guides will appear to help you. If you say, everyone's going on this trip this year and I'm going to, then no guides will appear. Your adventure has to be coming right out of your own interior. And if you are ready for it, then doors will open where there were no doors before and where there would not be doors for anyone else. And you must have courage. It's the call to adventure, which means there is no security, no rules. So I did have a lot of these magical guides who cropped up when I started traveling to France. There are two stories in the book about Henri Cartier-Bresson, the photographer. There are three stories about Vincent van Gogh. There's a story about Madame Simone Renaud, who was the wife of the mayor of Saint-Mère-Église, which was the first town liberated on D-Day. And she offered me healing for a grief that was tearing me apart. And Winged Victory, which I'll talk a little bit about later. And I was changed. When I first traveled to France in 2005, I had no creative life, and myself was fragmented. So what I found in France was an engaged way of communicating, and my intuition was ignited. As I mentioned before, I found a healing for the grief. I had lost my sister. I lost her in 2006. And I found this pace there that matched my pulse. I'd like to show you the trailer for the book. The filmmaker I work with is a Dutch filmmaker called, his name is Roger van Beek Kachouin, and we filmed a documentary which I'll be talking about in a bit, but we made three short films about stories in the book. There's one about the signs story in which I am walking around Paris making wish after wish after wish on my last day there, and a disaster occurs and all the wishes come true. And then there's one called The Mirror of Montmartre about how the area of Montmartre, it's about the history of that area and how the place sort of unmasked me. But this is the book trailer, and I'd like you to pay special attention to the very last scene in this film. It was shot from the Pompidou, the last day of our filming, and I'm going to refer to it later in the evening.
I was drawn to France and returned again and again, beckoned by unlikely guides, writers and artists and filmmakers and friends, and Claude Monet, Henri Cartier-Bresson, Coco Chanel, a statue, even a set of 17th century ceiling beams, who escorted me back in time through revolutions, wars, rains, and riots, down medieval staircases deep into wild forests, up onto parapets with panoramic views, and around in concentric circles, coming closer and closer to the X on the map. These guides offer gifts, music from metro stations, compassion from a woman in Normandy, wings from victory in the Louvre, which caused me to feel the sensation described by the French word chantepleure, to sing and cry at the same time. I hope that my stories of characters and connections, signs and secrets, transformations and belonging resonate with you, call up echoes of your own tales, tempt you to travel and tap into your dreams.
The book is laid out in chapters of three stories each, 15 of which are previously published in a wide variety of publications, and 15 are new. And they're arranged in kind of a deep, deeper, deepest arc. I have this method of writing and travel that I teach that I'm going to talk a little bit about later called deep travel, in which we start asking ourselves questions about images and scenes that stick with us after our travels. So the first chapter is Les Deux Garçons. It's about my son Brendan and his friend Corbin traveling through France. And the first story in the chapter is called Two Boys in a Bistro, in which Brendan and Corbin are sort of bumbling around Paris and they finally find their travel feet. The second story is one which I'm going to read in a minute. And then the last story in the chapter, they're up at Pointe du Hoc in Normandy, up on the plain high above the Normandy beaches where they're changed to the bone. So the book also kind of follows this arc where, as the book goes on, the stories get more personal and more kind of transformational. There are over 100 sketches in the book by Anne Elkins. She's an artist who lives in the Ashland area, and I'll show you a few throughout the evening, but I will be happy to give these away after the evening so you can tuck them into your book. So There are, I think, four on the table back there. You can help yourself, and I'll have some up here. So please ask me for any that you like. It's my wish that you find in my book a new way to experience your travels. How can I set such an audacious goal? In this story, I'd like to introduce you to my magical guide who taught me how to set goals. This story has had a rather long life. It was first published in Points North Atlanta magazine, and it was then on the Traveler's Tales site for Editor's Choice. And it won a Silver Solus Award for Culture and Ideas, and it's included in this anthology, The Best Women's Travel Writing. Much of the story takes place here at Musée d'Orsay. Daydreamer, quote, "Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dream with open eyes to make it possible." T.E. Lawrence, Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Corbin looked as though he had left his head in the clouds as he stumped down the stairs of the Eiffel Tower. From the Champ de Mars below, I kept my eye on his blonde head, bobbing above the others in his fast-growing teenage body. "You should never have left him up there, Brendan. How will we find him in this mob?" I hissed. "I don't care if you got vertigo. Get up there and grab him before he's completely lost." We were already an hour late to meet my friend at Musée d'Orsay, where she and I would visit Georges Seurat's pointillist paintings. In peace, I hoped. By the time we retrieved Corbin, walked along the Seine, rode the metro, and arrived inside the museum, my lofty aim to turn these two into art aficionados had shrunk to a disappearing dot. "Here," I scribbled a list, remembering how they'd always loved treasure hunts. "Find these in the museum. I'll meet you here in the lobby in 1 hour. They were getting hungry. That was all the time I'd have. The list. If you've been to the Musée d'Orsay, you will probably recognize many of these items. Statue of a woman's head cut off at the neck. Painting of guys playing cards. Statue of a girl in tutu with real tulle, hair, ballet slippers. Painting of empty church, blue inside. Find the Louvre across the river. Surely they could. Painting of people dancing outside. Black and white photograph by Degas, painting of snow, Opera Garnier model, big clock. What if we can't find all this stuff? 1 hour. What's a tutu? The artist was obsessed with the weather. In 1885, he was chasing clouds in Outre-Tot, France, engulfed by a surging desire to capture the sea on canvas. One day, he was on the beach at his easel, and as mist rose off cresting waves and droplets of white foam and caught the sunlight, he painted in a fevered froth. When the moment passed, he saw that he had done it. He had caught the sea. But, he noted with despair, he now needed the matching sky, and dusk was falling. He returned the next day, and absorbed, did not hear the increasing thunder of the waves. He later wrote, "I didn't see a huge wave coming. It threw me against the cliff, and I was tossed about in its wake, along with all my materials. My immediate thought was I was done for, as the water dragged me down. But in the end, I managed to clamber out on all fours. But Lord, what a state I was in." Oscar was soaked. His palette had splattered his beard with blue, yellow, and green. His painting was torn to shreds by the sea, that old hag. He needed identical conditions to appear and remain long enough to complete the painting. If only he could suspend time so that a shadow lingered before skittering off. The light brightened a fraction and held, and the clouds stopped. Oscar cursed, slashed his paintings, and became terrified of light. "I'm very unhappy, really miserable, and I haven't the heart to do anything," he wrote. "The painter in me is dead. A sick mind is all that remains of me." Before our trip, in my quest to interest these two teens in art, I left heavy tomes, Art Through the Ages, Treasures of the Louvre, Musée d'Orsay, lying on top of Sports Illustrated around the house, but they served as mere paperweights. I wish just once someone would pick one up and thumb through it. During our week in Paris, I dropped tidbits about the Impressionists. Cézanne was the grouchiest, kind of like you, Brendan, last night when you were trying to pronounce Bouffe Bourguignon. He was from a place called X. Van Gogh slashed his own ear. Could have been too much absinthe or epilepsy. No one knows for sure. This statue by Rodin is of a famous writer, Balzac. They both emitted joking hacks. What's so funny? Balzac. I shared my wisdom. This artist was wealthy. That one went by his middle name for years. Another strapped paintbrushes to his arthritic hands. Brendan and Corbin's eyes became hooded. They puffed out their cheeks, stifling yawns. Still, I stopped them at Rodin's statues, smiling at their snickers, pointed out artist studios, and planned a trip to Giverny. I knew they'd like that pond. After our trip to Musée d'Orsay, we had lunch in a café. "What did you like?" I asked, flushed with hope. Perhaps they'd spotted Impression Sunrise, the painting that had defined the movement. Nothing. Back in the day, the critics didn't like those works either. They rejected them for the big Paris art salons. So the artists got together and had their own and called it Salon de Refusé. "There was this one painting," said Corbin. "It was of a fence in the snow, and there was something really cool about the air." "Yeah," said Brendan, and I could tell this was the first time they discussed this. "That was wild, like I felt the air." In the early years, the artist's obsession had been survival. He and his wife and son had moved from place to place, creditors in pursuit, and often went hungry. He penned a constant stream of letters. "Please, I beg of you, send me a bigger sum tomorrow without fail. I am utterly without hope. For a month now, I have been unable to paint because I lack colors. Right now is the sight of my wife's life in jeopardy that terrifies me." His wife had another baby. Their desperation continued, and she died. We lingered over dessert. "What else did you see?" Brendan and Corbin smiled at each other and nodded. I was going to talk to her, but she looked Czechoslovakian, like Maria Sharapova with green eyes. Their goal was to exchange sightings and bonjours with girls from as many countries as possible. A bevy of gesturing Italians, willowy French girls, tall Swedish beauties. Perhaps it had been vanity for me to think I could lure them into appreciating art. The artist's lasting obsession seemed impossible. His work began to sell, and he married a woman with six children. They lived in the country, where he could finally paint in peace, out of doors with a lasting supply of paint. He squinted at red poppies and let their edges ravish his canvas as they had his eye. In quest of the luminous envelope surrounding the model, he placed a woman at the top of a hill holding a parasol. Every whoosh and wafting breeze appeared in her white dress as clouds spun past. He caught the Golden Thames at sunset, gondolas shimmering in Venice, a small red house in Normandy. He wrote, "It's only now I see what needs to be done and how." His dream was far-reaching. He'd articulated it once and knew people thought him a bit mad. He was driven, regardless. Then his eyesight began to go. 6 months later, I remembered the single painting that had attracted Corbin and Brendan. Yeah, I remember the painting of the snow, the one that showed the air. Corbin drew a picture, a fence with a ladder on the left and a bird on top, a house on the right with trees in front. Brendan's drawing was identical. Yep, the painting of the air. He caught Corbin's eye, but it wasn't the most beautiful thing we saw that day, was it? Green eyes. I blew the dust off my Musée d'Orsay book, finding Sisley and Pizarro, impressionists who had often painted snowy scenes. I interrupted the boys' viewing of a college basketball game on TV. Is it this one? No. The halftime buzzer rang. This? No. Let's find it, said Corbin. He grabbed the book, and Brendan hauled himself out of the recliner to flop onto the couch. Heads together, they lingered on images of ships sailing on green, squiggly seas, apples leaning against blue china pitchers, pillowy nudes and patches of sun. Here it is. The Magpie, a rare painting of snow, completed the year his rejection at the Salon had caused him to conclude, "I can no longer claim to cope." I knew that the artist had achieved his goal. Quote, "I am chasing a dream. I want the unattainable. Other artists paint a bridge, a house, a boat, and that's the end. They've finished. I want to paint the air which surrounds the bridge, the house, the boat, the beauty of the air in which these objects are located, and that is nothing short of impossible." Claude Oscar Monet. Thank you. You recently had Ross King here, whose book Mad Enchantment is about the water lilies, and he talked about Monet's spasms of joy. And he also mentioned that Proust said that Monet's work was like psychotherapy. And I did bring a little image of the painting if you want to look at it later. So travel. If the great affair, as Robert Louis Stevenson said, is to move, then it doesn't matter how far. You can find something transformative if you go as far away from here as Point Reyes. It's all in how open you are to the connections and the secrets and the connections. It's about you in the world and the world in you. These stories take place all over France. There are several in Normandy and Bordeaux. There's one that is set in the Jura Mountains between France and Switzerland. It's called Jurassic Cheese, about the source of food and the source of the Lisone River there and the source of the stories we tell. There are several in Provence and Auvergne. And after I had traveled to France for a while, I realized that I was seeing the place through what I think of as rosé-colored glasses. And I was also seeing myself through that in that same view. So when I first started traveling there, I felt like I was very savvy and sophisticated, and I knew the tiniest bit of French, but I just felt like I had mastered the language. And I also felt that the things that I found there were only to be found in France. And the reason it turns out that I thought that was that they were missing from my life. So I gradually started bringing home the things that were so prevalent there. So, you know, in between soccer practice and baseball practice, we would have dinners. We would sit down with my sons over candlelight and have these long, lingering dinners where we savored everything. We would have conversations. Pretty soon their friends started coming and staying longer. And Corbin always calls them bohemian conversations. So I would like to do this little exercise with you. I teach writing periodically when I go there at Shakespeare and Company Bookshop down on the Seine. And I do this with my writers all the time. And this is how I edited this book. And this is how I wrote these stories. And I also teach on trips called Deep Trowel that you can also find online. So I'd like you to think of an image from one of your recent travels, something that touched you, something that has stayed in your mind. And I'm going to ask you to keep this image in your mind for a week and start asking yourself questions. What were the scents and the sights and the feelings when I was there? What is it about this scene that touched me so much? What is happening in my life that is somehow connected with this scene? And I think you'll be surprised by what you find. I always am. And I'm starting a newsletter, and the sign-up is back there, but I would like to engage with you on this. And the newsletter is intended to invigorate your travels by offering some of these questions that my mentors, my writing mentors, have asked me that led to these stories and that I have worked with other writers on. The Mystique of Art chapter has, the first story is Apropos de Paris. It's about Henri Cartier-Bresson, the French photographer who kind of materializes and joins me on a walk along the Seine and points out how he photographed his home and then challenges me to write about my home in the same way. The next story is about, it's called Eye to Eye with Van Gogh. It's about the self-portrait. There's a postcard of it on the back table. September 1889, very light-colored swirls, kind of a pretty self-portrait that Vincent did. But there's something that he put in that painting that really revealed so much about himself and really helped me to write in a more honest way. And then the third story in this chapter is Winged Victory. And I'm just going to read the very beginning of it. Imagine being placed at the top of the main staircase inside the most visited museum in the world. Daylight streams from a ceiling of high white arches, bathing and illuminating you in shimmering light. You are exposed with no shield from thousands of daily visitors. You have neither head nor arms. Winged Victory leans forward on the prow of her ship atop the sweeping Darius staircase inside Musée du Louvre. Her legs, caressed by wind-whipped fabric, are sturdy. Her chest is held high, and her feathered wings fly out behind. She beams with boldness. She knows exactly who she is. I clicked along the marble floor in my Franco Sarto boots. A modern woman, chic, savvy, worldly. But when I saw her poised up there, admirers from all over the globe gazing worshipfully, I stopped and stared. I'm not easily intimidated, but she had me. Winged Victory had something I lacked. There is a story or a chapter in the book called The Story Keeper. It's about a film that Roger and I did. It's a short documentary, and he put it up on YouTube for the duration of my Wings launch. So you can find it if you just type in Aaron Byrne Wings. You can watch the film. It's 24 minutes. It's about Renée Sérolis, who is 7 years old in occupied Paris, and a B-17G crashed in his neighborhood. there were three dead men in the plane. And he spent years of his life piecing together the stories of all 10 crew members. He brought two survivors back to Paris to offer them healing and closure. And he invited families of the fallen and took them where their loved one died and told them the story of what happened. We did a festival run in 2013, and the film did really well. And Renee won the Medal for Veterans of Foreign Wars from the U.S., but this is the first time anyone had told his story. So the chapter in the book, Mentalité Terrible, is the first story describing the conditions in occupied Paris. The next story, The Boy and His Shield, takes you closely into the life of this boy and shows you the events that were really traumatic that led up to this crash for him, which I think it's fair to say traumatized him. But in putting together these stories and offering them to the people who needed them most, somehow he himself was healed. The signs chapter in the book has three stories. It talks about how when we travel, we are sometimes more attuned to real signs when we're trying to locate places, but also to signs of things that happen to us. It's like being removed from our regular routine sort of heightens our perceptions. So the first story in this chapter is in the current Best Travel Writing anthology that just came out in October, I think, right, Larry? There's also, Kimberly also has a really awesome story in this about Morocco that's also in my Morocco anthology. And this is one of the sketches that goes with it. Takes place in Arles. And Arles is one of those words that probably some of you can say it much better than I can. I never can quite get that guttural Arles. Arles. So I'm just going to read the very beginning of this story. But I actually do believe if we truly set out to walk in someone's footsteps, we set in motion events that make it truly so, and sometimes we get much more than we bargained for, and that's what happened here. Quote, "What else except pain and suffering can we expect if we are not well, you and I?" Vincent van Gogh in a letter to Theo van Gogh. What if all you can do is all you can do? Curl up. Breathe, exist, breathe, exist, in, out. During the 2 years Vincent van Gogh lived in Arles, 1888 and 1889, the mistral, the keening, tree-leaning, untamed wind of the south of France pummeled him and gave his mind what he called a queer turn. He fixed his easel in the ground with iron pegs, tied everything down with ropes, and let the mistral gust the colors through his body, out of his hand to the brush and onto the wobbling canvas. Sometimes a very spiteful and whining wind forced him to lay the canvas flat on the ground, crouch over it, and work on his knees. The wind rattled the shutters in my hotel room, in Hotel d'Arlatan, each tat, 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 a nail into my head. I curled tighter into the fetal position. So the story alternates back and forth between what's happening with Vincent and what's happening with me. So I'm going to read one more short story, and maybe we can kind of all feel like we're coming back into the present moment. I've read this at nearly every event I did in the States because it sparks a discussion of history and perspective that I think is very interesting. No matter what side of the aisle you're on, yesterday, last night, and today has been a little traumatic. I spent a sleepless night with my gut curled. I was curled in the fetal position, just like the beginning of that story. And my gut kind of felt like a snail, like going into myself, because this election has been so divisive. I think we need a place to put our pain. I suggest we share it. In common, we do have a wealth of comfort, of kindness, and of hope. I just heard that next week Sting is going to do a concert at Bataclan. And I know that things are in turmoil in France and Paris. But it reminded me that recovery takes time. There's a phrase in this story that many of you probably know if you see it written, but I didn't know if you'd recognize it if it's spoken, and it's c'est bon, and you'll find out what it means. Out into Paris. Quote, et maintenant, on fait quoi? And now, what do we do? Cover of Le Parisien, November 2015. Now walk, kick leaves, continue, said Roger in the Luxembourg Gardens one day in early November. Cut, it's good. C'est bon, I said, and we laughed. Late afternoon light lent a glint to raindrops as if to preserve them. Nearby, a woman in plaid wool rested upon a bench. A girl and her mother huddled under a pink polka dot umbrella. Students sauntered past, gesturing. A statue of Pan rose above a ring of violet pansies on a green scattered with leaves of rust, amber, and scarlet. We strolled around the central pond, the Grand Bassin, noting different languages spoken in muted tones, children pushing sailboats with sticks and dabs of drippy color, everything that made this exact spot the X on my soul's map. We were filming a book trailer and had shot in the Louvre scenes of winged victory, who in these pages rustles her wings and teaches me how to catch air in mine. I envisioned workmen prior to the German occupation wheeling her down ramps to be whisked off for safekeeping, and I imagined victory resuming her rightful pose after the liberation. I remembered that in 2013, again she was moved, restored, and set back in place. We shot scenes in Cours du Commerce Saint-André, the alley behind Le Procope, the oldest cafe in Paris where Robespierre dreamed up the terror, where Dr. Guillotine practiced his invention on sheep. Arched cobblestones, hanging iron signs, and latched shutters evoked those days when Parisians were petrified. We filmed in Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, where the remains of Saint-Geneviève, patron saint of Paris, lie. In the year 451, Geneviève ordered Parisians to stay in their homes as Attila the Hun approached. His hordes left, but the next day people flocked to the common well to draw water, their sense of safety shaken. The week of filming celebrated all I love about Paris. People welcomed us graciously, showed interest, and eagerly offered ideas. A book signing here, a party there, anything at all. In cafes, connections sparked, continual electrical currents. At sunset, the sun flickered as flaneurs wandered along the quays or stopped to listen to jazz trios jamming on bridges. The city invited all to be enthralled, charmed, romanced. As usual, I taught a writing workshop, read in an underground cavern, and planned to host a salon. At my previous salon in March, friends Jane and David had presented the topic of their upcoming book, Charlie Hebdo, and we'd had hours of discussion, searching for consensus and considering terrorists who acted outside the parameters of our own cherished values. Friday evening, 18 of us gathered in my apartment on Île Saint-Louis, drank champagne, tasted fromage, and shared storytelling secrets. Later, people drifted out the door until only a few of us lingered. Gonzague, late, walked in and said, "Something's happening." He opened the window. Sirens wailed. The phone rang. It was Martin, who left a half hour earlier. "It's a terrorist attack," he said. "Shootings everywhere. Don't go out." Later that week, we would learn of personal connections. Hannah's partner worked with the manager of Bataclan who died. Anne's friend had been shot in the arm. And Christophe's sister, who lived around the corner from Petit Cambodge, had phoned him as people fell. But that night, all we knew was that we couldn't go out into Paris. We awoke to warnings, but this city is known for her unceasing enticement to join in, to engage. Feeling oddly driven to attempt to save Paris, as if I were some sort of expatriate Genevieve, I crept to the café on the corner, and later the bistro across from it, then home. Sunday, across the river, and look through the fence into sun-dappled Jardin des Plantes. Vacant benches, silent paths, as in Anthony Doerr's scenes during the occupation in All the Light We Cannot See. Still, I felt an affinity with others who were not quite sure what to do but had dared to come out. Each day, Paris beckoned me. I thought of all the times that people driven inside by violence and terror had ventured out again. Medieval wars with England had seen many doors padlocked, then opened. The Parisians of Les Miserables had hidden behind barricades, but just decades later came Haussmann's era, when everyone flocked to balconies and boulevards. Throughout history, in heeding her call to return, Parisians had reclaimed their city. Monday, I peered through the Luxembourg gates, locked, as the palace was home to the Senate. Here in spring, bands performed polkas. In summer, Chopin resonated from a sunlit piano. In autumn, children chased through puddles. And now, chess players should be contemplating their chins buried in scarves. Peace felt out of reach. Sirens blasted nonstop. Raids were launched all over Paris, in Saint-Denis, in Belgium. People lit candles in République, laid flowers at Belle Equipe, set up a piano outside Bataclan. Marking a week since the attacks, Parisians reclaimed terraces. For as human beings, the only way we can overcome terror is to return to our rightful places. In an odd twist of timing, Jane and David's book came out, Charlie Hebdo, hashtag Charlie. Roger sent footage of our last scene, shot that Friday afternoon, a panorama from the Pompidou of a tumultuous slate sky churning with roiling clouds, a storm approaching Paris. I went to sparsely populated bookstores, bistros, museums, and concerts, always contriving to be near the Luxembourg, still closed, with armed gendarmes everywhere. On this last day, before returning to the U.S., I wind my way through the left bank and dine near Saint-Sulpice at Chez Fernand, usually packed on a Sunday. Today, there are many empty chairs. I sit at a red checkered cloth table and savor Boeuf Bourguignon and Cote du Rhone. I head toward the Luxembourg. I need it to be open. I need to see how Parisians are there in that place. I need to walk that loop in order to recalibrate my compass. The gates are open. Few people drift around. No band plays this November day. Still, there is something essential here. Sky clear and blue. Voices muted, calm. A breeze rustles leaves, lifts my own hopes. Paris continues in concentric circles. She will be restored. Sable. Thank you. So I reserved a little bit of time for questions.
Our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Aaron Burns speaking about our book, Wings, about travels in France. Who has a question for Aaron? First question. So your travels there, you said you went and you were guided. In what way were you guided by the history of it, or how did Vincent, for example, influence you when you walked in his footsteps?
Well, when I walked in his footsteps, I found that, you know, when we travel, we like to plan everything out. And so I had that trip to Arles. It was like a pilgrimage to go see him. And so around the little town are placards with images of his painting. And so I wanted to go in his footsteps and see that. And that's what I wanted to do there, was pleasantly walk around and view his work. Instead, what I experienced was much closer to the hell that he actually went through when he was there. And so I found that I felt like I knew him better, and his work from that period and the period that followed had such a different meaning for me than it would have if I would have just pleasantly walked around and looked at his paintings. So, go ahead.
Yeah, and your sons, or your son and his friends, how much have they taken an interest now? That must be 10 years ago or so that you had this experience, right?
Oh, yeah, they still do. In fact, Corbin's planning a trip back there, and they always, as I said when I talked about that chapter, they were really changed. I mean, they always talk about Claude Monet, you know, like he's their friend, you know, because they saw that in his painting that he intended to put there. And so they love, you know, I always send up postcards of that image. And but when they talk about Normandy, it's with a much more, it just gave them such a grasp of the sacrifice of the Allies and of, you know, they were 17 when they were there. And so they knew that many of the men and boys there were a little bit older than they were. And so it really gave them, I think, a sensibility about war and a sensibility about history. And Corbin's grandfather had been there. And so he talks about that now. And, you know, it really forged a different bond between he and his grandfather, too.
You spend a lot of time on Paris. Outside of Paris, what's your next, in Arles, what's your next place in France that draws you there over and over again?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, Normandy always draws me because of the history, because I have a little bit of a fascination with World War II and that time period. And I also feel like, you know, with Veterans Day coming up, there aren't that many veterans of that war still alive. And I feel like we need to attend to them and honor them, and listen to them. So I find myself drawn back there. I went for the first time south to the French Riviera to Saint-Maxime with Kimberly last summer, and it was just so beautiful. And you know, everywhere you go there are different cuisines and, as you know, and different wines, but also the histories of the places are woven into the present in a way that's very fascinating to me. There's a story in the book called Wise Beams about 17th century beams in this apartment that start sort of telling me stories about the history. And that's what I feel like when I'm there. It's this way of history infusing the present, not just being, you know, in the past, sitting still, but infusing the present.
How did you move from your first trip to Europe or Paris? And tell us when that was. And to your new version of deep travel, as you call it.
Well, I started traveling in 2005, and that was when I started writing in 2007. And then I traveled a little bit South America and some different places around the world. And my friend Christina had been in Morocco, and I had gone to see her. And the truth is, my love affair with Morocco was very tumultuous at first. She was in Fez, and when I went to see her, the place just flattened me. I really did pass out after walking through the souk there. And so Christina then had this idea of doing a writing workshop there. And so she said, you know, she invited me to teach. And I had taught periodically at Shakespeare and Company. Whenever I was in Paris, I would just sort of get my group of my flock of Paris writers and teach there. And so the first trip we did there, actually Kimberly came along, and that was in 2014. And we had 12 fantastic writers. And then I also went last fall, right around this time, and we taught a writing workshop. I taught with Doug Cordell, who's a storyteller in the Bay Area. And we worked with the master storyteller of Marrakesh and the master storyteller of Fez. And these guys are legends. If you go to my website, you can find a link to a Al Jazeera half-hour special about Hajj Ahmed Azargani, who's the guy from Marrakesh. But teaching that was just, you know, basically we started teaching and then I realized I have nothing to teach. I just have it all to learn. And so anyway, she's done trips to Nepal. I think she's doing one to Mexico in February. And she's doing another trip to Morocco, two trips to Morocco. One, Tim Cahill is teaching. And on that one is in March. At the end of March, I'm going to come and launch this Morocco anthology that I put together there. So, continues.
You mentioned some of the other books that you've written. Which do you have a favorite? Is this now your favorite, or do you?
Well, this
I know
one
it's
is
a very unfair question to ask anyone.
Well, the other two are anthologies that I edited. So, this one is probably my favorite because it's a collection of my writing, but all of the pieces in all of these books have the same, you know, remember when I asked you to think of that image and sort of toss it around next week? All of the stories come from that kind of exercise. And every writer who I've ever worked with who does this, and including myself, is always so surprised because we think we are fixated on these images and scenes, and we don't ever see the connection between the scene and ourselves. So the other two books are vignettes and postcards. They're on the back table. The first vignettes and postcards I just put together from a workshop I taught at Shakespeare and Company. And then Reputation Books, the publisher said, why don't we do a new edition of this, and then you can do anthologies from, you know, whatever destinations you want to do. So we did a new edition of the vignettes and postcards from Paris, which includes stories. I know you had Don George here recently, and there's a story by Don, Le Bon Vie in Paris, that's really awesome. There's a story by Georgia Hess, who we kind of call the grand dame of travel writing. She's the founding editor of the Examiner travel section, which at the time she was editing it had 16 pages. There are two poems by Billy Collins in the book. And those stories, so what we did with that book was we took the first part and set you in Paris, and then the original stories written at Shakespeare and Company are in the back part of the book. So the Morocco book is it all takes you to Morocco. In the Morocco book, I had people who were along on the workshop, and then I just started asking my friends. You know, Kimberly has that awesome story in there, but I asked Jeff because I knew he, in his book, The Size of the World, he traveled around the world without leaving the ground, and I knew that he had a chapter in Morocco. So there are three sections of stories. One is a conversation he had with Paul Bowles. They're really fabulous, from Jeff. Rolf Potts is another friend, and he had gone around the world without baggage, and he had this vest that he just crammed everything in. So I knew he had a story about Chef Shawin, so I got that from him. And then I asked Michael Chabon, had a story about driving around Morocco and having lunch in an unlikely place. And so he contributed that. And then I asked the Paul Bowles estate if I could have this just sublimely lovely, lovely piece of writing by him called The Baptism of Solitude. So that's in there as well. And then we put an afterword in the book, which is about Hajj and the storytellers and that whole tradition of storytelling and his story. So
you've mentioned both in the video and recently about this 17th century ceiling with the beams, the 17th century beams.
Right.
So how did the beams take you deep?
Well, you know, this is kind of interesting because I launched the book here in the States, you know, in the spring. And then I went to Paris and invented Shakespeare and Company and did events all over Paris. I actually did a concert with the guy who see playing the guitar in the Metro. It was really awesome. But in Paris, you know, here I say, you know, I saw this guy, Larry, at my first book launch, and Larry's like, tell me about these stories, you know, and I said, well, you know, Vincent van Gogh, he was my guide through France, and he just said, what are you talking about, you know, he's like, what do you mean, he's dead, you know, but people in Paris, when I did this, they were like, oh yeah, wise beams, the beams, they tell me stories too. You know, they're like, Henri Cartier-Bresson had a few secrets for me. So it's this way of, it really, really felt like that quote by Joseph Campbell, like, because these guides turned up. I mean, the first story about Henri Cartier-Bresson, I hear his name in my ear at 3:30 in the morning, and I kind of am led on this wild goose chase to find his work. And he had this way of photographing where it was all centered around what he called the decisive moment, which was the moment when he snapped. And his approach was entirely intuitive. They said he was like a dragonfly leaping around the streets of Paris taking his photos. And so it just was a time in my life when I was very out of touch with my intuition. And so every time I would learn something different about him, I would start playing with my own intuition and experimenting like that. And then when those things happen, and I'll be really, really eager to hear, if you do this thing with the image, if you hold it in your mind, you just end up running into these things related to it. You know, you walk over and you open a book and, you know, you let's say your scene is in Rome at the Trevi Fountain. You just walk over, you're not really doing anything. You open up and there's a section about the Trevi Fountain in Rome. And then someone comes up to you and says, you know, I'm going to Rome. Haven't you been there? You've been, you know, it's that is the way it happened. And so that's why I love the Joseph Campbell quote, because he calls them magical guides, and that's how I think of them.
Well, that's a perfect end to Travels Through France. So thank you very, very
much, Erin. Thank you for coming. So, you know, I have these sketches, and I was going to stick them in the books, but if you already have a book, just maybe I'll just put them all back on that table, and you can help yourself. I brought 10 sketches. So thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. So ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 114 years of enlightened discussion. Thanks.